This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Every now and then I pass a car with an "I brake for moose" bumper sticker on the back, and I always think, well, duh, who wouldn't brake for moose? Those things can kill you if you run into them. But there are all kinds of other animals vulnerable to hard-charging motorists, the kind that barely make a thump as your tires roll over them. But you feel awful, or at least I do. State officials are working on understanding where and how animals are crossing our roads so that we can minimize the risk to them and to drivers. Today on the program, we're going to talk about roadkill, how it's dealt with, and how it can be prevented for the health of all our species. I'm joined now by James Brady, an environmental specialist for the Vermont Department of Transportation, and Jens Hilke, a conservation planning biologist for the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thanks to both of you for being here today.
Great to be here.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Let's talk about some of the sort of basics of roadkill first, and then I want to go much deeper into this question of movement and animal habitat and cohabitation and how we can actually all work together. But just on roadkill itself, James, does anyone actually keep tabs on how many Vermont animals are being killed by motorists around the state?
I wouldn't say keep tabs. There's so many animals that range from, you know, a salamander up to a moose, as you were saying before. So it sometimes you don't even know if you hit an animal, like you're saying. So what the protocol is when there's a strike, either the police, state police will find it, or the VTRANS district forces will find it. And then first step is to move it off the road and then into a safe place. And then the next is to hopefully harvest the animal, and that's where the game wardens can help out with that. And if not, then it's brought off-site to an area where it's safe to dispose of.
Really? Because my understanding was that that's no longer happening. I mean, you'll still see, especially if you drive on I-89 this week, there are a couple deer that have been there all week. So it doesn't look like anybody's coming to pick them up and dispose of them. I thought now the policy was just let the other critters take care of them.
Well, yes and no. So as long as they're not in the travel lane, it's not the highest priority. Our district forces are constantly battling many issues with water damage, anything that come up. There's a storm coming up next week.
Joaquin.
Yes. So as long as it's out of the danger of the traveling public, it's dealt with when possible.
And is there a difference between what VTRANS might take care of and what a municipality might do? I mean, do town, like city centers, have a different policy? Because I haven't seen a lot of, you know, squirrels in downtown Burlington on the roads.
That's a good question. So we deal mostly with the state system, so I can't really speak to how it varies from town to town. Different towns have different restrictions they're just overworked, some of them, so it depends.
And Jens, when James talks about the possibility of an animal being harvested, and that goes down to the game wardens to do that or to the state police, I mean, obviously we're not talking about a salamander or probably a squirrel, but can you talk a little bit about how that might work? Who gets the meat if there is an animal that's harvested and able for people to use?
The game wardens take care of helping to take that harvested animal and give it to needy people that they know in the community. So I think there isn't a precise protocol exactly as up to their discretion in terms of how that's dealt with in the most suitable manner.
And does Fish and Wildlife want to keep tabs on how many animals are being killed on the roads?
Yeah, that is very important information, and there is a system for keeping tabs and just knowing how many roadkill there are across the state, but it hasn't been working well because there's so many different sources of information. So the VTRANS district staff might write down a paper form that's then submitted to their headquarters and then goes into their database. The state police that respond to accidents would have their own reporting system. And with the state police, that may or may not actually be flagged as a wildlife-related incident. You know, if the animal is still part, you know, in with the vehicle, you know, then they'd clearly count it that way. But if a driver swerved to avoid an animal, it might not have been counted as a wildlife-related event. And then lastly, the game wardens respond to those sorts of issues as well. So there are at least three different data streams but also the public at large, where we really want to get information from. So we're in the process of developing an online reporting for wildlife observations. That's still in the works, but the attempt is to move towards a more systematic way of collecting that information, because it is incredibly important to us.
So if somebody does run over a possum, say, and you know that feels awful about it, but knows that that possum is dead, you still want them to report that, even if it's not going to be anything that the game wardens need to get involved in or state police, you know, no damage to the car, but obviously fatal for the animal.
Yeah, we do want that information. And as I say, the system isn't up right at the moment, but we're very anxious to collect that, because we really need to know, you know, where are the hotspots from a driver safety perspective, but also where are the hotspots in terms of animal movement. Some of those animals might have, you know, just been crossing the street from one block of habitat to the next. Other mammals might have been doing a much bigger trip. And in either case, we need to know about it.
What do you want to know about how the state handles roadkill, listeners? Now's the time to ask your practical roadkill questions, because we're going to make a turn pretty quickly here into talking about what roadkill actually represents, which is this clash between animals and humans and how we can actually mitigate animal mortality and keep drivers safe, and how we as drivers, as humans, should think about our relationship to the animals who also use the same pathways that we do. So if you have a question about roadkill policy, or if you want to weigh in on that broader discussion about cohabitation, you can call now, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We actually got a note from the conservation organization Cold Hollow to Canada, who posted on our Facebook page saying, in the northern Green Mountains, we are building off the work that VTrans and Fish and Wildlife is doing to understand road crossings in our region. This spring, we'll launch a citizen science project called Wild Paths in order to add to the data collected. Folks can volunteer to walk, ride, and drive roadways and report both successful and unsuccessful crossings. So one other way that people can get involved in doing that. We got a note from John and Charlotte who says, if drivers exercise more caution, they can avoid most roadkills. Also, with modern automobiles running so quietly, drivers should take the opportunity to train wildlife in near collisions by using their horns after they brake to avoid the animal. Making wildlife frightened of cars will potentially save their lives in the future. And Mary says, every day I drive on the roads in my beloved Vermont, I see animals lying dead as the result of human negligence. Songbirds, cats, owls, hawks, deer, coyotes, chipmunks, squirrels, bear. These are some of the precious creatures I see killed. The problem is not the animals. Our roads cut through their habitats. Humans are the ones at fault for not paying attention and driving too fast. The same behavior that puts other humans at risk. James and Jens, I'd like for both of you to respond to those. But James, you first. I mean, certainly there are times when people are driving too fast and that results in a collision. But there are other times when, you know, you may be driving along and a squirrel darts out and you don't really have the ability to stop in time to save the animal. I think most people would try to save an animal if they could. So, you know, what's your advice for drivers?
That's what one of the things we're trying to figure out is what areas are important for crossings, because it is unpredictable. A lot of our highways in Vermont have trees and hedgerows directly up to the road, and an animal could be running through the woods, and by the time it gets to the road, you don't see it. So it's, in terms of, I think, just be aware. You never know what to expect. It's not much else you can do. Our hope is to keep the wildlife off the road. That's what we're working hard to do, to limit those interactions in the future.
I remember when I took driver's ed in Rutland, I was always told by the driver's ed instructor, don't swerve to avoid an animal because you may either cause a collision with another car or roll your car into a ditch. It's more dangerous for you as the driver to swerve to avoid an animal than it is to actually hit it. Is that still the advice that you would support?
I would totally agree with that.
Okay, yes. So drivers, you know, you want to avoid an animal, but don't swerve?
Yes, and maintain control of your vehicle is definitely high priority as a motorist.
Jens, John and Charlotte had also said use your horn and honk at an animal if you do manage to brake in time to avoid a collision, to let that animal know that cars are scary. Is that good advice? I mean, I think a lot of animals see the big car once you've had that near miss and it doesn't look like they think that it's a friendly vehicle.
Yeah. I mean, that's solid advice in the sense of you know, helping to make it a more traumatic experience for the animal. But I'm probably, you know, my guess is that it's already a traumatic experience for the animal. The perception of roads, and particularly high volume traffic roads, is pretty intense from a wildlife perspective. And they can smell it, and they can hear it, and then see it much sooner than you might think. So, you know, for some species, crossing a road is just a traumatic event in and of itself, and maybe the horn is just an added disincentive.
We got a note from Gary who says, I have a question. What is the proper thing to do if you see a deer or other animal that is injured or dead on the side of the road? So those are maybe two separate questions, but maybe the same thing. James, what should somebody do if they see an animal?
I would recommend calling state police, obviously not the emergency line, but you can let them know, and then they can either deal with it if it's a road hazard immediately, or get a hold of our district forces to come and clean it up when able.
Yeah, go ahead, Jens.
The state police are in contact with the game wardens. So if the animal is just hanging out by the side of the road and still alive, they'd likely contact the game wardens, and then the game wardens would deal with the situation in an appropriate manner.
And let's go to Adam, who's calling in from Whitehall, New York. Hi, Adam. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, my question, last year I was on my way home at 2 o'clock in the morning from work, traveling 22A, when I hit a deer in Shoreham. And, of course, being from New York, if you hit a deer, they send out a police cruiser. And at that hour, they didn't. But they seemed to be more concerned with what the sex of the deer was, where the deer was located, where could they find it, and so forth. I was just wondering if that was standard protocol for all the deer-related questions. They were more concerned about the deer than they were damage to my vehicle or the property damage. So I was kind of off-put by that.
Because, Adam, you also wanted them to be concerned about your property damage. Is that what you mean?
Yes, I actually had to fill out the vehicle report myself, which is weird because we don't do that in New York. The police officer does. So,
Adam, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. I'm getting some quizzical looks from our guests here. But, Jens, I mean, why might whoever responds be interested in knowing some of the vital statistics about a deer in that kind of case? I mean, we'll leave it to the state police maybe to talk about who should fill out an accident report. But why is it important to know more about the animal?
Just knowing more about the animal just gives us a broader context for what animals are moving and what animals are getting hurt by the road system. And so it just helps fill out our understanding of what the situation between the interaction of wildlife and roads really is.
And is this really the crux of the point here? When you see roadkill, I mean, when I see roadkill, I think, oh my gosh, that poor animal. But when you see it, do you think we have a tension point here between human behavior and animal behavior?
Not necessarily. No. Of course, it's a tragic event for the animal, and I'm sure it was traumatic for the driver involved. And so I'm not taking that lightly. But it very much depends on the species and sort of the larger population dynamics, how much of a problem that is. The estimates for the number of deer that are hit on American roads is pretty huge. Nationwide, I think it's at least more than a million deer a year. I believe that's work from State Farm Insurance. They've been tracking that nationwide. But an individual event, a roadkill event, isn't necessarily going to affect the whole population of deer. By contrast, with some amphibian species, if you have a high volume traffic road section, you could significantly impact that population in that one or two night of migration related to the breeding behavior. Or with turtle populations, often it's the female that's migrating. They're very long-lived species. You can have a significant impact on the whole population with just a few roadkill events. So it very much depends on these sort of larger issues, to what extent that might be a danger to the population.
Well, we're going to get into more of that coming right up, and more of this idea of, okay, but the roads are built, so what do we do now? How do we better understand animal behavior, whether animals are migrating? migrating or maybe traveling between two blocks of habitat, and some of the work that the two of you have been doing with others on how to better understand what's happening in some of those high-impact areas like I-89 between Bolton and Waterbury, a spot that a lot of drivers on our highway will recognize. And listeners, if you want to weigh in, if you want to talk about what you see as good solutions, how you modify your own behavior, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're looking at how state officials are trying to curb the problem of roadkill by working on better access for animals to the habitats they need and when those habitats cross roads. We started out with a discussion about how roadkill is handled in our state, but we're moving on now to a conversation about conservation and habitat and the cohabitation of humans with big, fast cars and animals. What questions do you have? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're talking with VTRAN's environmental specialist James Brady and conservation planning biologist Jens Hilke with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And let's take a few calls. We've got a lot of listeners who have thoughts on this. Paula first in Hebron, New York. Hi, Paula. Go ahead. You there, Paula? All right, we'll see if we can get Paula back. Let's go in the meantime to Dave, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Dave. Can we get you on the air? All right, so we seem to have a problem with our phones. In the meantime, I'll ask a couple of questions. I'd love to know a little bit about this project that I sort of hinted at before that you guys have been working on in the Bolton to Waterbury area, where there's I-89, there's Route 2, and two very important habitat blocks. So, Jens, maybe you could talk a little bit about what you guys are doing, and it's a collaborative process here to try to better understand wildlife movement.
Yeah, I'd like to start by zooming way out. So if you look at the whole state of Vermont, we've got a long chain of mountains, the Green Mountains, obviously, and I-89 separates the central greens from the north greens. That section between Bolton and Waterbury is sort of a critically important potential barrier between what's a 72,000-acre block of forest on one side and a 54,000-acre block on the other side. So just in terms of landscape context, it's an incredibly important spot. And then when you zoom in and look at the actual road section, you know, there are a variety of potential barriers. The highway itself, there's right-of-way fencing. There's about a 3.5-mile section of Jersey barrier, that concrete glare barrier, where the two northbound and southbound lanes are pretty close together. There's a railroad. There's a river. There's River Road. So there are a variety of potential barriers lined up in that really important connection, eco-regionally important connection between the North Greens and the South Greens.
Yeah, which, I mean, I guess if you could go back, it seems like maybe that's a little bit of an unfair barrier to create for animals. If we could have created our roads more with animals in mind, might we not have done that in the first place?
Well, let's also be careful about calling it a barrier. It's a barrier for some species. It might not be a barrier for others. Mm-hmm. One of the pictures that I gave you all to put up on the website is one that James got of a red fox coming out of a 345-foot or 320-foot long culvert.
Yeah.
A culvert.
Culvert, 300 feet long, goes under both barrels of I-89 and Route 2. It's a dry culvert about 5 feet wide. We didn't know fox would make that sort of trip. And maybe that particular individual was just, you know, especially gregarious. But maybe that's standard procedure for a fox. So we need to be careful about to the extent to which roads are barriers to wildlife. It's a very it depends kind of answer.
Mm-hmm. On what species and maybe what time of life or what they're actually trying to do as well?
Yeah, and also on factors like traffic volume and the time of day of that traffic. You know, there's a lot of wildlife movement that happens at what we call crepuscular hours, dawn and dusk. And at some times of the year, our regular kind of rush hour, and I put that in air quotes, our rush hour traffic is more closely aligned with dawn dawn and dusk, and at other times of the year it's not. That may prove to be a much more significant factor than we understand. So in some ways, we're really just at the beginning of this larger understanding of the interaction of roads and wildlife, but we're realizing that factors like that are important.
And James, how are you going about trying to figure out what the impacts are and what times and what species and all of that stuff that Jens was just talking about to figure out in this specific location and then maybe expanding it to other places, how we can sort of help animals do what they need to do?
So this area in particular, the Bolton to Waterbury stretch of 89 US 2, has been on the conservation radar for as long as the interstate's been there, it seems. We just didn't have the data to say yes or no, this is a barrier, this is actually causing an edge effect, we need to do something here. We know that the lands are there, we know that the habitat blocks are good, they're protected by state and federal rights, and so we knew this is, okay, this is an area we really want to start digging in deep. There was a recent project on US 2 where they reclaim the road, which is basically a more intense paving project where they basically dig the road up and do drainage improvements, and they fix the curvature and make it a safer, better road. That said, it wasn't a project to rebuild a bridge or to put in a new one or anything like that. So we put our heads together to say, okay, is there anything we can do in relation to this project to help answer this question that we've had? And the Federal Highway Administration allows for some project funds to be used for mitigation. And we were able to use some mitigation dollars associated with that project to develop a 2-year wildlife study that incorporates 40 cameras, camera traps, in and around the road and bridges, and also having expert biologists track during the snow to get a better sense. And we're just finishing up on that study right now. We're really excited to find out what it shows us.
Do you have any thoughts so far on what it's showing you?
Yeah, we're learning a lot. It's wildlife never ceases to amaze anybody. We're learning that the Jersey barrier, which is about 5 feet, normally during when the plows put snow next to it, some of the animals will actually climb over it like a staircase. So there's seasonal variability we never knew about. I have 5 different species that I've confirmed with a camera that are using that same 300-foot culvert to climb under, and it's incredible. It's been really, really interesting.
Jens?
I just wanted to make the point, the Bolton Waterbury study is one, but this is a much broader work, and a lot of it is under the umbrella of the Staying Connected partnership that both the Agency of Transportation and Vermont Fish and Wildlife are partners in. And also, we're partnering with the Nature Conservancy of Vermont, University of Vermont's Transportation Research Center, the National Wildlife Federation. So there's a whole host of public and private conservation NGOs and practitioners that are really focused on this issue.
Nature Conservancy, I think, put a note on our Facebook page as well about some of the work.
Oh, great. Yeah. So that's one of the other they're coordinating 2 camera trap projects with us, and that's an additional almost 90 cameras. So all of that data, it's not just the Bolton Waterbury stretch or just the other 2 projects. That's all coming together to give us a better sense of how the actual system of wildlife movement meshes with what our models are for what we think is happening. So we've done a tremendous amount of computer modeling to figure out, well, where is there habitat on both sides of the road? And now we need to move beyond the models and get to, okay, well, what's actually happening? So the camera trap work on all 3 of those projects that James just introduced and the tracking are ways of getting from those models to what really happens. And in some parts of Vermont, our models are quite good, and it's fairly easy to predict where wildlife will cross the roads. The Champlain Valley, a more highly fragmented landscape. In other parts of Vermont, say in the middle of the Green Mountains, it's much more difficult to predict an exact position because there might be 3 miles of woods on both sides of the road. And so from a wildlife perspective, any one of those spots might be a suitable crossing zone. So, you know, we're trying to move from these models to the real world, and the camera traps and the road tracking are ways that we're doing that.
We're looking today at animals crossing roads and that intersection between human behavior and animal behavior and how we can keep things safe for both animals and humans. Let's see if our phones work again. I want to go to Kevin, who's calling in from Jericho. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I was calling to find out if anyone there knew about the effectiveness of deer whistles, which I've used for years. They're two devices that mount on the front of your vehicle and, from what they say, give off a high-pitched sound that is not audible to us but is to the deer.
Kevin, thanks for the call. Either of you have Jens, you're pointing to yourself. You think you can tackle this one?
I don't have specific research that speaks to those. So I can't answer that question directly. But, you know, the deer are a very interesting species because they'll handle they'll cross in a lot more places than other species will. So finding technologies that warn the animal is a really appropriate way to go. And I wish I had good studies to see about those whistles in particular and to what extent they work.
We did read one article in preparation for the show that said this particular article said those whistles were not very effective in actually preventing deer and car collisions. But I don't have empirical data on that, but I think it was a Deer and Deer Hunting magazine we had read that was looking into that issue. Kevin, thanks for the call. Let's go to Skip calling in from Norwich. Hi, Skip.
Hiya. I run Route 2 between St. Jay and Lancaster, New Hampshire at night quite a bit, and I see moose frequently. Nothing reflects on a moose, and if Fish and Game is tagging moose, I recommend a little reflective paint, or maybe even get the paintball people interested in hunting moose.
Skip, thanks for the call. Jens, any thoughts on that?
You're right. It's very difficult to see a moose at night. One of the options we're exploring is a wider fog line. So that's the white line on the right-hand side of the travel lane. And so you can't see a moose. You don't get much of a reflective eye shine or anything like that. But sometimes the break in the fog line can be an indication that there's something big and dark in the road next to you.
That's a great idea because, yeah, then you'd have that big break. Interesting. Steve's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Steve. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm wondering if there's been any design or planning around the wildlife crossings that you see in Europe, especially Germany. They're basically three-lane overpasses that are left wild, planted, and especially on the known corridors, probably most applicable to moose and bear. More so than deer, but have we planned ahead for better budget times for that kind of crossing?
Steve, thanks for the call. Jens and James, both of you can probably weigh in on this. Who wants to start? Yeah. Jens, you're chomping at the bit.
It's a great question. James and I just came back from the International Conference on Ecology and Transportation, where there's a tremendous amount of focus on wildlife overpasses. So we know of some great examples across the world where that is working. When you look at Vermont species, I'm not convinced that that's the gold standard for the Vermont transportation system, because as you point out, it is mostly for bear and moose. And so we have some anecdotal evidence at this point that eastern moose will drop their heads and move under structures that are move through structures under the road that you might not expect. And black bear in Vermont will also do that. So I'm not saying they'll squeeze through a tiny culvert, but some of the underpasses we have may function for bear and moose. So then it becomes a question of is the expenditure of creating a structure that's only for wildlife worth it compared to what we can achieve by underpasses, existing bridges, existing culverts. In those cases, we get multiple benefits. We get flood resiliency. Generally, we get aquatic organism passage, so the stream is a natural stream bottom. And we'll get dry land on both sides of the culvert or bridge to allow for terrestrial movement. So personally, where I'm at is thinking more about let's look for those co-benefits and look at that larger system that way, and for now not push the expenditure for just wildlife.
But James, then how does V-Trans retrofit roads? I mean, in some of the articles that I was reading again before the show, it's things like thinking about what it will take to get an animal to feel comfortable crossing in a place that's safer, like an underpass, or like adding dirt rather than a stone or a harder structure. So what's V-Trans thinking about in the realm of what Jens was talking about?
Right. So Vermont, we don't build a lot of new roads. So we're constantly dealing with maintaining and making what we have now safer and up to the standards. So what we look for is the best ways to retrofit or to design when a bridge is being replaced, these kind of win-win situations, as Jens was talking about. And one of the ones we're working on is we have a new standard where instead of large boulders under a bridge to protect the infrastructure, we put waste material like dirt and grubbings to make it easier for animals to actually cross under the bridge as opposed to climbing over boulders. It's simple and it's sort of a lot of bang for your buck.
Well, I hope you guys will keep us posted as these develop, as you learn more from your study and as you think about how to make roads safer for drivers and for animals, but also do these things that actually make animals cross where perhaps is safer for them and where we want them to. James Brady is an environmental specialist for the Vermont Department of Transportation. Jens Hilke is a conservation planning biologist with the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jane.
Coming up, science writer Elizabeth Colbert says climate change is precipitating a mass extinction of species around the planet. We'll get her thoughts ahead of a talk she's giving in St. Johnsbury. That's next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Climate change is blamed for a lot of things, including perhaps a new wave of extinctions. Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine, and she says we're facing that predicament right now. It's the subject of her latest book, The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Colbert lives in Williamstown, Massachusetts, and spoke with VPR's Rick Singeri.
Describe the premise that in the natural history of the planet, there are distinctive periods in which massive numbers of species have gone extinct.
Well, it's not really a premise. How's that? It's empirical fact as well as we can piece together geological history. And in fact, it was quite contentious, but the evidence for it just became overwhelming. And the idea is that there have been these moments and they're not spaced in any particular way. They seem to be very random moments when, for whatever reason, and the reasons do seem also to vary, you get a large number of species, a very large number of species, going extinct, you know, in a geological sense, more or less simultaneously. So in the normal course of events, we have what are called background extinction rates, and that means there's a sort of tick-tick species come into being, they speciate, and they go extinct, all very slowly, at a fairly regular and very slow and very imperceptible, you know, in a course of a human lifetime sort of way. And then in these unusual moments, there have been five what are called major mass extinctions in a half a billion years, so they're very unusual. You suddenly get extinction rates spike up very, very dramatically.
Tell us about the first extinction.
Well, the first of these so-called big five took place quite a long time ago in what's called the Ordovician period, the end of the Ordovician. And at that point, so we're talking about around 440 million years ago, most of life was confined to the water. There was very little life on land at that point. So the world was a very, very different place. And most of the big groups of creatures that went extinct at that time, because it is so long ago, would not even be recognizable to us today.
The most recent extinction is one people are probably familiar with. It caused the end of the dinosaurs. What lessons or instruction does that event have for people now?
Well, that is the end Cretaceous extinction, and it fascinates people for many obvious reasons. As you point out, it did in the dinosaurs. It also did in a lot of other groups of very dominant creatures, creatures that we once again would consider very strange now, marine reptiles, huge marine reptiles, for example. And it seems. There's a very broad scientific consensus that it was caused actually by an asteroid impact. Most people are probably familiar with that. And I think that the lesson, to the extent that there is a lesson here for mass extinctions, and for that one in particular, is that when conditions on Earth change very dramatically, groups that had dominated the planet for a long time, so like the dinosaurs, a very long-lived and very successful group, suddenly can go extinct, the whole group. So we're not talking about, you know, just a couple of species of dinosaur. We're talking about many, many species of dinosaurs that went extinct at the end of the Cretaceous. And the question of why dinosaurs failed at that moment, whereas mammals, you know, early mammals who are our own ancestors, managed to squeak by, is a question that people are fascinated by, but at this point can't really answer.
You write that the sixth extinction is occurring as we speak because of climate change. So describe how you see this.
So there's a couple things I want to say. First of all, this is not my, you know, point, my idea. This is very prevalent in the scientific literature right now that we are either on the verge of or even in the midst of another mass extinction event. Whether it will rise to the level of these other events is, you know, very much unclear at this moment. We have to hope very much, you know, for the sake of ourselves and everything around us, not. But extinction rates are very, very high right now. That is sort of not a disputed idea. That's just a fact. They're very high. They're on the order you would expect to see during a mass extinction. And another amendment I should make is that this event, it's not just attributable to climate change. It's attributable to the many ways that we are changing the Earth on a geological scale. So, for example, you know, we are changing the surface of the Earth very dramatically by cutting down forests and planting monocultures. That's a big, big change. If you're a creature that lived in that forest, that's obviously a huge change. Mm-hmm. We are changing the climate very rapidly. We are changing the chemistry of the oceans very rapidly. That's sort of the flip side of climate change, that a lot of the carbon that we're releasing is ending up in the oceans and acidifying the oceans. We're moving species around the world that turns out to have often very deadly consequences, and we can see that right now in the northeastern United States, for example, with the recent introduction of a fungal disease that has killed off a tremendous number of our local bats, who used to be very, very plentiful and very healthy populations, are now struggling populations because of a fungus that was introduced very recently, probably from Europe. So these are ways in which, you know, human activity is changing the world very, very dramatically. And unfortunately, as that list suggests, there's not just climate change. There are many things happening simultaneously.
We've already had five of these great extinctions. And doing the math, they've occurred basically on average of every 96 million years. So the last one was 66 million years ago. We're really kind of due for the next one in 30 million years, give or take, right? So isn't it just a predictable extinction in a series of great extinctions?
Well, I mean, the point that I tried to make at the beginning is actually, you know, people did, when this concept first came widely accepted in the scientific community about maybe 20, 30 years ago, so it's a pretty recent, you know, discovery, if you will. People did look for periodicity in these extinction events, and there were theories, but all of those attempts to find some kind of regular appearance of these events have failed. So it's now pretty, you know, almost universally agreed that these are very, very random events. So there have been, you know, five in a half billion years, but that doesn't mean that they've happened every 100 million years. They have actually, you know, happened at very different intervals. So, you know, are we due for one? We are not due for one. You know, would there have been one at some point in the future of life had we not come along and started to precipitate one? You know, quite possibly. But, you know, when would it be? Would it have been, you know, now? Would it have been 100 million years from now? Those are all, you know, sort of equally likely.
We've lost many species in the history of the planet, yet we march on. So why should we care about losing more species now?
Well, I think there are a lot of different ways to answer that question. One way is to say that we inherited a world that was extremely diverse, a high point, really, of diversity on the planet, probably. And we are unraveling that very, very quickly. So we are basically destroying the diversity and variety, and I think many people would argue the beauty of the world that we share with all of these fantastic creatures. But if you really want to get into, you know, what does it mean for me or my kids or my grandkids, besides, you know, that they won't see elephants or giraffes or all these animals, you know, that are endangered, at these moments of mass extinction, the rules change. The world changes. For some reason, the world is changing. In our case, the world is changing because of our own actions. And that changes the rules of the survival game. And you don't know what groups are going to come out at the end of that. And the dinosaurs, you know, had they been sitting around having radio interviews, you know, before that asteroid hit, would have said, well, we will certainly be fine. But that was a bad bet, you know. And in our case, we are messing with some very, very basic biological and geochemical systems on the planet. And, you know, unfortunately, at that point, all bets are off. And it's not, a moment of mass extinction is not a moment when, as a species, you know, just on an odds-making sort of way, you want to be around.
So, Elizabeth, is there hope? Is there the potential to avoid or stop the sixth extinction?
Well, I think that the answer to that is obviously for those species that are already gone, and just about every month we find a new species that is probably winked out on our watch. For those who are gone, I think there clearly is no longer any hope. For those who are down to their last 100 individuals, the hope is very slim. For the many, many other, you know, probably millions of species out there, most of them, you know, insects, to be honest, who are still out there, there certainly is hope, but human impacts are extraordinarily great at this point. They are on the level of, you know, the great geological forces of nature. We're changing the world in a lot of different ways, very, very fast, and that's very difficult for species to keep up with. And if we are going to confront this issue, unfortunately, what makes it, you know, the super challenge of our time is that it's not just one issue that needs to be addressed. Unfortunately, it's several that need to be addressed pretty much simultaneously.
Elizabeth Culbert is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History. Elizabeth, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Culbert will be speaking about extinction tomorrow evening at the Fairbanks Museum in St. Johnsbury. She spoke with VPR's Rick Singeri from her home in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Now for the mailbag, when we read your comments and emails. And I'm joined by VPR and Morning for Monet. Wait, who are you?
Who am
Just
I?
Tell me who
what
you are
we doing
Just
here?
Tell me who you are.
Jane, my name's Patty Daniels.
Oh,
and
hi.
We work together every day on Vermont Edition. Let's go to John.
All right, that's probably the way to go.
Who wrote in about our discussion this week about Volkswagen and the emissions scandal and how it affects Vermonters. John writes, as a lifelong owner of VWs, I am shocked and disappointed by the company's duplicity. My daughter, her husband, and my sister all recently purchased VW diesel Jetta wagons, largely because I encouraged them to. So I, too, feel cheated.
And John went on to ask, as bad as VW's fraudulent actions are, why is no one asking why it's okay that thousands of other diesel-powered vehicles, like pickup trucks, are still permitted to spew far more noxious pollution into the air?
But Michael in Richford posted on our Facebook page asking why anyone thought the issue was such a big deal. He says, who really cares? It's not like it was defective brakes or something that put lives at risk. Make them pay a fine, install the real software, and move on.
All right, so we'll move on to another topic. On Monday, we discussed strategies for the prevention of suicide in the state, which has a significantly higher rate than the national average. One anonymous listener wrote in and says, this is a complex and misunderstood topic. I think we need way more education. And as a survivor of two serious attempts, I'd like to say that people don't choose suicide, it chooses them. The stigma of feeling suicidal needs to be erased.
And our listener continues, there is shame, there is stigma. Good support and healthcare is crucial, but more work is needed to stop the misunderstanding about brain health in general.
A lot of response as well to our show last week on the Bernie Sanders campaign. One take came from John in South Stratford. He says, as one who was inspired by JFK challenging us to ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for the country, I'm struck by how little the Sanders campaign has addressed this aspect of the social contract.
And John says it would be a great addition to his campaign if Bernie were to develop programs where young people across the economic spectrum could serve our country. This could be in exchange for college costs or perhaps help with a first mortgage. Build on models like the Civilian Conservation Corps.
And finally, in response to our show exploring apple season in Vermont, Michael wrote in with a complaint. Hard apple cider is far too sweet in the U.S. and Canada. I grew up in England, Michael says, and hard cider there has a bite to it that's missing here. I keep trying different brands, but I have yet to find one that's drinkable. I've seen sugar, corn syrup, and maple syrup on hard cider labels. Why is this necessary?
Why indeed, Michael? If you have advice for him, you can always post it on our Facebook page. You can also find us on Twitter, at Vermont Edition, or send us an email, vermontedition@vpr.net.
And Patty, speaking of our Facebook page, I want to let people know that our guests from earlier's segment on wildlife crossings and roads, they sent along some photos taken from their game cameras along I-89, including the fox crossing out of a culvert that James Brady had told us about. We have those photos up on our Facebook page now. Just search for Vermont Edition on Facebook. Patty, thanks for joining me.
You are welcome.
All right. If you're already fed up with U.S. election politics, take note. This Canadian election season is only 78 days of campaigning. Jealous much? Voting in the federal election in Canada is just over 2 weeks away. So tomorrow on the program, we'll talk about the five major parties and what Americans can learn about how the Canadian parliamentary system works. I'm Jane Lindholm, and I'm going to stop talking now.